Today on Against the Grain, can an anonymous alternative currency, not tethered to the oppressive arm of the state, make us free? That's the premise behind Bitcoin, invented less than 10 years ago, which has soared stratospherically and then, recently, fallen sharply. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll talk with David Golombia about the right-wing libertarian ideas behind Bitcoin and how people on the left might well be wary of them. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The cryptocurrency Bitcoin was invented in 2009 and has had a tumultuous history since then. While designed to be a stable yet anonymous medium of exchange, its value has swung wildly, plunging enormously in just the past month. Critics have likened the popularity of Bitcoin to other speculative manias, like the tulip bulb frenzy of the 1630s. But my guest today argues that Bitcoin is popular for another reason. David Golombia suggests that Bitcoin is appealing because it embodies a set of ideas with deep roots in the American far right, premised on the notion that state regulation is the enemy, an argument he makes in the book The Politics of Bitcoin, Software as Right-Wing Extremism, published by the University of Minnesota Press. He teaches in the English department and the Media Art and Text PhD program at Virginia Commonwealth University. David, let me start by asking you, how does Bitcoin differ from other currencies?
When you talk about Bitcoin, it's kind of important to think of two different things that in many ways are very, very separate. And the people who talk about Bitcoin will sometimes talk as if these two things are the same, and it can be very confusing. There is the Bitcoin software that runs on thousands or tens of thousands of computers worldwide. And they say that that software is distributed or decentralized because it can run on any number of computers. Anybody can run it if they want. Running that software these days occasionally produces some Bitcoin for the person who's running it. Okay, but that software is only run by a very small number, by a minority of the people who are interested in Bitcoin. The other thing we talk about when we talk about Bitcoin is Bitcoin the coin, or Bitcoin the digital currency. And that is accessible to anyone, regardless of whether they have any interest in that software. And when you look at Bitcoin the software, it's very interesting and unlike almost any other software that has existed. But when you look at Bitcoin the coin, or the currency, or the digital currency, it is very similar to a lot of other instruments that exist out in the world. It's just a thing. It isn't even really a thing. It's just some digital numbers, and it has a ticker symbol associated with it the same way most stocks do. The symbol is BTC, and you can go on to any number of exchanges and use your dollars and buy some BTC, however much you want to buy, and you can then trade it if you want. There's, of course, more than 1,000 other cryptocurrencies that are like Bitcoin. You can trade among them if you want. You can buy some and hope to sell it for a profit. You can do other things people do in the stock market, like shorting it or lending it to other people. But in that way, the Bitcoin, the coin, which is what we mostly talk about and is the thing that has gone down in price spectacularly over the past month or so, that is really not a very complicated thing to understand. It is really very simple. It's just a token that you buy and sell the same way you buy and sell a share of Apple, or slightly more exotically, you buy a pound with a few dollars, or you buy some yen with a few dollars. That's basically it.
So if I wanted to go and buy something and I have some Bitcoin, how possible is it for me to use it like another form of money?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, because, you know, the global name for these tokens is cryptocurrencies. And that suggests that the main use of them is currency. And currency, which is, the definitions of that are a little hard to get your head around, but it's easier than money. Currency suggests that you can buy and sell things with it. But the fact is that very few people use Bitcoin to buy and sell things. They use Bitcoin to invest in it, or really to gamble with it. And in that respect, it is not being used as a currency. These exchanges that I just mentioned have very little to do with buying and selling anything except Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies in a speculative manner. People for a while, they were working hard to try to get vendors to accept Bitcoin, and there are a few that will accept it. But in reality, it appears that the number of people accepting it has gone down over time rather than up. And part of the reason is pretty easy to understand. It's because the coin itself is so volatile in price. And that is actually that deters merchants from wanting to use it, because it requires you to be constantly adjusting the value of your stock and all the other parts of business that go, that involve currency. It's a pain. So really the only place that people use cryptocurrencies as media of exchange is in the dark web markets, where you buy things like drugs and weapons. And that's mostly because most of the other forms of currency you could use in those markets don't allow you to use them there.
So the appeal then of Bitcoin, putting aside the point that you're making, which is actually most people are not using it for buying and selling, but for speculation. But just holding that thought for one moment, if someone is to use Bitcoin for buying something, then the appeal of Bitcoin is the anonymity of the process?
Well, the problem is it's really not anonymous. I mean, it is sold as being anonymous, but it isn't really anonymous. And a lot of people have gotten in trouble with that. I think the real appeal is that, if you go into the dark web and you go into one of these drug supermarkets, like the most famous one was the Silk Road, and the guy who ran that is now in prison. You could literally buy drugs with some Bitcoin directly, right? You could just move your Bitcoin using the techniques they have for moving them. And the fact is that if they had tried to use any other form of exchange for that, like, say, credit cards or PayPal or other means of moving dollars, that would have been trackable by the government. So what is really the advantage is not the anonymity. It's the fact that currently the government isn't able to track it doesn't automatically track all of those transactions. But the truth is it can track them retrospectively. So what they keep doing is, busting everyone who's running these drug supermarkets and then tracing the Bitcoin, of the big players for the most part, but they find all of it. I could explain why technically, but I guess the important point to say is that your name isn't attached to the Bitcoin that you spend, but the address at which you store the Bitcoin themselves is stored, and that address can usually be tied to your name, and so it's not truly anonymous.
Well, how is Bitcoin created? If we were talking about gold, you could say, well, gold is mined. How is Bitcoin made?
Okay, so if we go back to your first question, I talked about the two different aspects of Bitcoin, and the first was the software, and it is the software where Bitcoin is made. And it can be a little bit catty. The way some of the critics, including me, would say is what those computers are doing is wasting huge amounts of energy in order to validate each transaction that is put through across the network. And that validation requires each transaction to be verified many, many multiples of times, not just once the way it would on most ordinary financial networks. And that validation process is very difficult. Mathematically speaking, it's difficult. And it only succeeds in this kind of random way. Like if thousands of people will process the transaction and then it'll suddenly go through and I'm sort of collapsing some things, but essentially when a transaction gets verified, the computer that verified it produces some Bitcoin. That's called its reward. And that reward is the incentive for people to run this software. And back in the early days, in 2009, the difficulty of doing these transactions is purposely scaled upwards. In the early days in 2009, it was very, very easy to do this so that you could run the Bitcoin software on your own home computer, and you could generate, again, through this process of multiple verifications of each transaction, you could generate multiple Bitcoins for yourself within a few days on a home computer. So that is where a lot of Bitcoin millionaires came from. They mined, that's what they called it, right? They mined many, many Bitcoin for themselves, which at the time were worth almost nothing. Today, there are these server farms, most of which are reportedly based in China or in South Korea, that use huge amounts of electricity to produce even a single Bitcoin, because they're so much more difficult. And that's why we talk about it wasting energy. It takes a huge amount of power now to verify each transaction.
Well, listeners might be scratching their heads and thinking, wait a minute. So this was a currency that you used to be able to make on your home computer. What keeps Bitcoin from being just made willy-nilly? Could someone just become rich by going through this process? Now, of course, we do know that when we're talking about dollars, they're also generated in some ways out of thin air as well. And we'll get to that part of the story later. But how do we understand supply here, or why there wouldn't be oversupply if they could just be made through a number of network computers doing what is in effect a kind of a pointless algorithm?
Right. This is just built into the software as it exists, is that as each coin is generated, it becomes the difficulty of solving the problem that each of the computers has to solve becomes harder and harder. And this was done on purpose as the software was originally written. And it's turned out to be a real problem, because that difficulty means that transactions end up taking longer and taking more computing power. And that has resulted in real limitations in the network to process transactions. Reportedly, and I'm going to speak generally as of today, part of Bitcoin's purported benefit is that you could send tens of thousands of dollars anywhere worth of Bitcoin anywhere around the globe instantly without having to go through money laundering checks and things, which most of us might think are actually positive. And you could send it instantaneously. But in fact, because of the increasing difficulty of the Bitcoin processing, it can take from half an hour to parts of a day to your transaction not even going through today, because of the increasing difficulty. And in fact, the difficulty keeps getting increasing more and more. And so that in the Bitcoin software as it was originally designed and as it is running today, there is a hard limit of 21 million Bitcoin that can ever be produced. And that is partly based on some of the gold bugism that is built into the Bitcoin, which we can talk about later. But as you get closer and closer to that 21 million limit, it becomes more and more and more mathematically difficult to actually produce a Bitcoin. And it seems as if actually there will reach a point where it becomes, it's a losing proposition to do all the, to run the software so much that you actually generate a Bitcoin. And this is something that people wonder about. What happens when we reach that point where it is no longer profitable to do these transactions?
Tell us about the scope of the ecological cost of these server farms generating these algorithms to allow Bitcoin to function. Really, what kind of scale are we talking about here?
My understanding as of the last time somebody looked at this is that the Bitcoin network was currently consuming as much power as some of the smaller countries in the world. The last one I heard was New Zealand. So that is not an insignificant amount of power, and it goes up all the time. And, you know, some of the Bitcoin promoters will say, well, all financial transactions use power. And of course, that's true. But all financial transactions do not deliberately waste power in order to verify their transactions. So if you look on a per transaction basis, Bitcoin is just completely out of scale with any other kinds of financial, you know, any kinds of transaction. And also they have to keep doing it in order to keep the network running. So, currently, if it is the case that you know, China's relationship to this has become complicated, but at least for a while, there were these really huge server farms in China where electricity is cheap, but the electricity is produced largely by coal. So there was concern that this is an especially polluting form of currency creation, and that it's only going to get worse.
David Golombia is my guest. We're talking about his book, The Politics of Bitcoin, Software as Right-Wing Extremism. I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So Bitcoin, for the general public, seems like a very maybe esoteric, technical, financial creation that is a bit confounding. On the other hand, there are people who are very much drawn to Bitcoin on the basis of what it seems to point to in terms of the kind of world that we can live in. And I want to ask you, what ideas, what ideology is tethered to this idea of an anonymous, at least in theory, stateless currency?
Right. And this is really the big reason why this whole topic interests me so much. You know, there's been a strain for quite a while of a very strong right inflected, politically speaking, set of movements that have been associated with the computer industry and with people who are sort of outside the industry but very interested in computing, and that are focused in particular on encryption software. And the reason they like encryption so much, which is, you know, the process of making things scrambled so that they can only be read by the intended receiver, is that at a very basic level, they think that that encryption can hide them from the state. And a lot of these people are very overt anarcho-capitalists, right? The movement associated with people like Murray Rothbard and Hans Hoppe, who are, you know, pretty extreme individuals. And there is this kind of loathing of the state, along with a real, if a little bit hard to penetrate, but a very, very strong free market ideology. And these people, the most familiar names that they go by are the crypto anarchists and the cypherpunks. And some of the most famous members of them are Timothy May, who was the guy who founded the crypto anarchists, Julian Assange, who was an early member of the cypherpunks mailing list, quite a few others of the sort of big names in the digital world who are not, you know, necessarily major executives, are well-known people who traffic in this area. And these people have been writing screeds and manifestos for decades, and one of their main targets has always been the creation of an alternative money system. And because they hate the state, they hate that they think the state has some kind of special control over money, and they believed that by building this alternative money system, they could demolish the state. And they've tried there have been many candidates for this alternative currency prior to Bitcoin, and they all had some pretty serious technical flaws in them that essentially made it very possible for the government to step in and shut them down and accuse them of money fraud and money laundering and all the things that they no doubt were doing. And so, you know, the Bitcoin paper that was published in 2008 by a pseudonymous person named Satoshi Nakamoto, you don't have to read far in it to realize that he's talking about solving these problems that the crypto anarchists had decided were problems for them in their project to create an alternative to state money. And this stuff is baked into the software model at an extremely deep level. The whole point is to build something that the state, in their opinion, can't govern or regulate. I think one of the good news pieces about this is that I do think they're, for the most part, wrong about that. They seem to have one of the early themes in Bitcoin discussion groups, which we even see today, is the belief that if you made money in Bitcoin, you didn't owe taxes on it because it was Bitcoin, which in their belief was outside the money's, you know, outside the state system. But the truth is, the IRS ruled pretty quickly that, of course, you did owe taxes on a profit that you made from Bitcoin, just as you would from the sale of anything else. And you know, this was a real surprise. If you go into some of the discussion forums, you can just, the surprise that the Bitcoin people have at this fact that, like, it doesn't matter that you declared your currency is outside of the state, you still owe money if you made profits, it's pretty remarkable.
And the question of profits is a central one, because although you're talking about crypto anarchists, these are people who, rather than being located on the left, are located on the right, anarcho-capitalists, people who see, when they think about freedom, which is a crucial concept for people involved in Bitcoin, it's the freedom, or it includes the freedom of the market.
Yes.
Can you explain that?
And the economic freedom of the individual, that is what they are about 100%. They believe that political freedom and the economic freedom of the individual to do whatever he wants is the only freedom that matters. And, you know, they have a lot of sort of decoration of that belief system that says, you know, that will mean we'll only have contractual relationships between individuals and nobody will ever harm each other for some reason that they can't really state. And, you know, this goes along with very well-known libertarian beliefs, like that there should be no regulation of drugs whatsoever, and that, in fact, whether or not you believe, you should be able to enact that policy even if the state you live in doesn't accept it, right? And there should be no regulation of weapons, which happens to be a big deal for a lot of these people, surprisingly so. So that, you know, Ross Ulbricht, the guy who masqueraded as Dread Pirate Roberts and ran the Silk Road, the first big drug supermarket, you know, he is to this day praised as a hero of freedom, of this economic freedom to conduct transactions however you want. And people believe he was railroaded and sent to jail illegitimately because selling drugs and weapons should be the right of anyone, regardless of whether that is within the law or not. And, you know, really remarkably, there is a claim that what he did didn't hurt anybody, right? And that's where you really, I mean, this person was helping to sell weapons and helping to sell heroin, you know, and fentanyl and all these very serious addictive drugs, as well as speed and cocaine and all these things, to lots of people. And it's really hard for me to look at that and not see that there is a pretty direct harm, even if he claims, you know, well, the people would have gone out on the street and bought it and they would have been subject to other kinds of danger from drug dealing. You know, that may be true, but it's hard for me to look at somebody selling heroin in dealer level quantities as being some kind of freedom fighter. And it turned out, you know, as so often happens with these far right ideologies, that when his economic freedom became threatened by the appearance that some of the dealers who sold on that site were going to expose him, he accepted some offers from FBI agents who were pretending to be dealers to kill the people who were threatening to expose him. And that was part of why he went to jail, is that they set him up to order murders on people, which he did. And reading the documentation of this transaction, he, you know, as so often happens, he really believed that his economic freedom justified that. And that is, you know, that is the selfishness and the Ayn Rand heroic individual and just the myopia of this kind of view that, you know, economic freedom is the only freedom and it ultimately justifies the individual doing whatever he wants to other people.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with the author of The Politics of Bitcoin, Software as Right-Wing Extremism. That's published by the University of Minnesota Press. You can find a link to it on againstthegrain.org. He teaches in the English Department and the Media Art and Text PhD program at Virginia Commonwealth University. Let's talk about the origins of some of the ideas that become reshaped under cyber libertarianism, which you argue really undergirds the larger ideological politics of Bitcoin and the appeal of Bitcoin to a whole set of people politically. And that is a series of ideas that come out of the very far right that center around questions of money and power. They come out of places like the John Birch Society historically. Tell us about the centrality of finance to the extreme right, why that matters so much to the arguments and the politics that have characterized the far right.
You know, some of that is probably a question better put to a political scientist slash historian. Although I've been, you know, I've looked hard for some of the scholarship on this, and it is a deep and interesting and abiding question. The conspiratorial views about money, you know, go back in every European country and in America as far back as you want to look. And they are often associated with whatever we might want to call the right wing at any given point. You know, the fights between Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson have this conspiratorial overtone about what is really being done with our money. And Hamilton wanted to create a central bank, and Jefferson and Madison thought that this would, you know, secretly give the power of the United States, its economic power, to England. And on the other hand, the Hamilton people thought that, you know, this distributed sort of finance that they wanted was going to favor the French. It's not hard to see that or to suggest that part of what is happening is that there is a great deal of inherited wealth among some of the people who promote much of the far right in the U.S., you know, the far libertarian right, the Heritage Foundation, the Koch, all the people that the Koch brothers finance. It appears that these people have a lot of savings sunk into dollars, but also gold and precious metals and extracted products like oil and coal, and that they fight tooth and nail against anything that might devalue the places that they've sunk their value. Is it the case that, for example, the Koch brothers or even the people who first floated the Federal Reserve conspiracy theories in the 1910s when the Federal Reserve was founded, that they themselves had a lot of money sunk into gold and were therefore worried that gold was going to lose its value and that they were going to lose their savings? I don't know that anybody has really done the scholarship to track that down. I think there's two things going on. I think that's quite possible that this was a very naked power grab and a very contradictory one, right? The overt public statement was gold can't lose its value. It's stable. It's the thing that's stable, and this paper money is going to lose its value. But in fact, what they were specifically worried about was gold losing its value, because it can lose its value, because, you know, what creates value in things is very complicated, and it isn't really about scarcity. Scarcity can be a variable, but it is not by any means the whole story. I think also there is something deeply psychological that makes this story very effective, that somehow people hear this story that, like, there should be a limited amount of money, and people who want to create money out of thin air are somehow playing a game that is illegitimate. And it's a very useful hook that you can use to grab at people's prejudices. And there's there's great scholarly questions here and political questions. Why is it that this is such an effective hook that you can attach things like racism to? But it is absolutely the case that we see, especially anti-Semitism, but even, you know, one of the big early outcroppings of this was in the late 1800s, when, you know, there used to be in the U.S. a silver standard as well as a gold standard, and there was a move to get off the silver standard and put everything into gold. And there was a tremendous amount of xenophobic right-wing writing against this, and it was not merely directed at the Jews, but it was also directed at the English. And of course, that is one reason why Lord Rothschild and his family are the ones who always figure in these conspiracy theories. He is both British and Jewish, and there is a tremendous long-term hostility in the U.S. against both of these groups. And, you know, somehow the idea that the British were going to steal all the money out of the U.S. and you know, which I think was that's conspiracy theory. I don't think that was really true, even though I'm sure the, you know, Rothschild was a very shady guy who would use any trick, like any banker, to get any amount of money he could. But the truth of that was the people who were spreading the conspiracy theories really were the ones who had the most interest in whatever commodity it was that they were worrying about. And it was, as it is always with these kind of xenophobic right-wing politicians, they blame this racial other for the thing that they themselves are doing.
And it gets complicated because these banking conspiracy theories, which, as you say, have a long history on the right, and often the Federal Reserve is at the center of evil, and there's a kind of cosmopolitan cabal who's in charge. It's the bankers, but as you say, there's often a very racialized way of seeing the bankers. Anti-Semitism often has a strong role in coloring the kind of specter of the banking class, this cabal, and theories about world finance being on the edge of collapse and the need for gold to stabilize things. There, all of these theories, we see them time and time again historically, and they come from the right, but often they get kind of muddy because they can be embraced by parts of the left or people who would not identify as people who locate themselves politically on the far right, because they can be confused for a larger critique of the system, which isn't just about finance, but also about production and about social inequality and elites versus the people and so on. So it gets very, yes, very muddy. And one saw that actually not too long ago with Occupy Wall Street, that there were a number of Ron Paul people who would show up at various Occupy Wall Streets with their theories against the Federal Reserve. Some people anyway made common cause with these people, assuming that the critique of banking was a left-wing one, not a far-right conspiratorial critique.
I could not agree more. I saw exactly the same thing when I participated in the Occupy movement here in Richmond, Virginia, where there happens to be one of the Federal Reserve central offices. And I am sometimes mistaken for being someone who thinks the Federal Reserve should not be criticized or that the banking system is terrific. And I don't think either of those things at all. But I think the specific critiques that are being launched by the people, the Ron Paul followers and stuff, they're just crazy conspiracy theories. They would not address the systemic problems that we have. They aren't left critiques. They use them. You know, I don't love the word entryism, but it is a really interesting way for people on the right to kind of, you know, whisper into the ears of people on the left that they have the same message and they don't have the same message. And but they can seem very similar in certain ways. And it's of course there are quite a few people on the left. I mean, I have gotten a fair amount of flack from people on the left who say, well, Bitcoin is really for us. And you know, when I try to drill down and ask them, you know, get into the specifics, how is it helping us? What problem that we want, that we on the left want to address, does Bitcoin solve? Either you start hearing nothing, or you start hearing some of these right-wing ideas about, you know, well, this stable amount of money is going to protect value and all these things, which are just, you know, if you ask a left-wing economist, they're not going to go along with it. That's just not the way the world works.
Well, why is a stable currency so important for the far right? And why is inflation seen as so dangerous?
You know, that's one of those questions that I wish I really had a better answer to than I do. I think it is very useful for them. Rhetorically, it's a very, you know, it is, you know, maybe an analogous question could be, why is it that that seeing the government, the finances of the government as being the same thing as the finances of a household is such a useful trope for the right? And one answer certainly is it's a simple model in which there is this kind of, you know, this hard and fast, very clear lines about how budgets work that are appealing to people who don't want to think about it, right? And the that is just false, right? The government is the one budget that doesn't work like a household budget or a business budget. It's not a valid comparison. And yet you can hear in the people who repeat it, like, to some extent, why it's so appealing and so useful. Like all conspiracy theories, right? What's happening is you're running into the complexity of the world that is in certain areas extremely high, and a lot of people don't have the time or the bandwidth or whatever to want to look into that and see the complexity. And so you give them a simple answer, and that just satisfies them.
So there's a whole history, as you argue in the book, The Politics of Bitcoin. There's a whole history of right-wing theories about the monetary system and central banks and the role of central bankers, the role of the Federal Reserve, the precariousness of the world financial system,
yes.
And then various answers that would save the little guy from those evil bankers. Now, of course, those of us who situate ourselves on the left see how the financial system and the monetary system, that banking, the bankers have played a role, among others, in contributing to the kind of extreme inequality that we live under. And then, of course, at the same time, the state has operated in the interests of, in many ways, redistributing wealth upward. And at the same time, we know about state surveillance as well, and Edward Snowden's revelations increase that. So you have a situation where there are a lot of reasons to be skeptical about the state in terms of privacy, in terms of wealth distribution upwards. And then you have an ideology which is very American, in many ways very widespread, that comes from the right, a particular take on the banking system and the solution through a mechanism like Bitcoin. How do you think these different strands have come together, particularly now under what you and others would call cyber libertarianism?
So cyber libertarianism, which is a term that a few scholars have come up with and that I've been working on a fair amount recently, is this kind of vague libertarianism that it's not identical with, necessarily identifying oneself as a libertarian or voting for the Libertarian Party. This is part of what is so concerning about it, is that a lot of people involved in technology buy into certain parts of a worldview whose origins are disturbing, and that with regard to specific issues makes them take what to me are positions that are pretty far to the right. And probably the issue that is the easiest one to grasp is about regulation, right? And we know that since the founding of the regulatory apparatus and government under the New Deal, this has been something the right has absolutely hated, right? They want to take every regulatory agency apart. And it just so happens that those regulatory agencies are one of the places where the left has gotten a little bit more power in government. So that we have things like OSHA that protect workers' safety, right, which is tremendously important. And of course, this is what the right wants to tear apart. This is what Trump is tearing apart with the Heritage Foundation, all of these regulatory agencies that in my view are, one of the, in at times have been one of the success stories of governance. I mean, there are problems with them up the wazoo, but sometimes the EPA has done good work to protect the environment, and OSHA has protected workers and so forth. And even though it's quite true that a lot of workers in Silicon Valley, for example, vote for Democrats, when you start to get into these issues involving digital technology and its regulation, they become rabid anti-state, anti-regulatory people. They want to see nothing about the digital world regulated. And the problem is that this creates a space of complete unregulated capitalism, and that, the power of Google and Facebook and Twitter and many others has been created by the lack of regulation that we see around them, right? And that is supported almost uniformly in Silicon Valley. That's what I call cyber libertarianism, in the sense that you have people who might well identify as Democrats even, but who if the government steps in and says, or somebody like me steps in and says, you know, the government should regulate Google more than it does, right? You would think that the skies had opened up and, you know, we're about to experience a cataclysm. And we see this happening today in the EU, where the EU has been far more aggressive than the US in regulating some of these companies or in proposing regulation. And it is hard to find people in the United States, with a few exceptions, who are even willing to say maybe this is reasonable. You know, the EU is very concerned with privacy. Privacy is baked into EU laws in a way that it is not baked into US laws. And they have come up with several different regimes, including most recently the so-called GDPR, which are attempting to really rein in what Google and Facebook and these other companies do with regard to use of personal data. And to me, it is a wonderful step in the direction of making it much more difficult for these companies and governments to do illicit things with our data. And, you know, one of the reasons you may not know about it is that we don't even talk about it over here, because it is so anathema to the basic view of the digital that has come through, that has been promulgated by these people, especially by Google, but quite a few of the other companies as well. And if I can connect this to Bitcoin for a second,
sure,
and to the other issue you were raising, right? Like, well, what does the left want to criticize about banks and Federal Reserve? Well, we could get into, you know, we could dig and say a lot of things. But one of the things at a very surface level is, in the late 1990s, the Glass-Steagall legislation, which had been in place since the 1930s in the wake of the 1929 stock market crash, was taken apart, right? And you had that, and then you had the creation of these special kinds of instruments, credit default swaps, right, and other exotic instruments like that, that happened to fall outside of any particular government agency to regulate. And people warned about that at the time. The head of the Commodities Future Trading Commission, Brooks Lee Bourne, there's a wonderful Frontline essay program about her. She warned that if you created this space of unregulated financial instruments, you were going to create an out-of-control bubble that was eventually going to take down much more than its own contained space. So in my view, there's two instances where the financial crisis of 2008 was directly caused by the removal of regulation. Regulation that looked like it was doing a very good job. Well, Bitcoin's solution to the problem, which actually came out of the 2008 financial crisis, was more deregulation, right? All over the Bitcoin discourse is the idea that it is a completely unregulated financial instrument, and that a completely unregulated financial instrument will solve the problems of global financial crisis and so forth. And, you know, again, this is more immediate politics. I'm not sure that long-term this is what I'd like to see, but in immediate politics, I think that's the opposite of the truth, right? It is deregulation that caused these problems, and we need those good regulations like Glass-Steagall to be put back. And stuff like Bitcoin that is, you know, completely deregulated, that can't possibly solve these problems. And in fact, as I have long predicted and other people have predicted, what do you get when you get this totally unregulated financial thing? You get boom and bust markets like crazy, where people end up losing huge amounts of their life savings if they are foolish enough to bet on it, and scams at a volume that you cannot even believe. And what else would you expect, right? But you can still find in the Bitcoin discourse even today that they are, you know, realizing this freedom that is denied to them in the ordinary financial system.
I'm speaking with David Galumbia about his book, The Politics of Bitcoin, Software as Right-Wing Extremism. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You were arguing, David, that with cyber libertarian ideology, that there is a notion that although for people who might even accept regulation in other parts of life, that we should not accept regulation to do with digital technologies. And there's, in fact, a notion that as digital technologies develop further and further, they will make us freer. So there's kind of a tech fetish that seems deeply embedded in the contemporary version of these ideas.
Absolutely. It's technological determinism at its at its best, and it is, you know, it's unmoored from reality. We see, you know, the places where these unregulated spaces have emerged, you know, seem highly associated with some of the rising fascism we've seen in the world. And there is a specific piece of legislation that deregulates all of these companies, and it's called Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, and it basically frames everything that internet companies do as speech at some basic level, and then it says they aren't responsible for the speech, and then they use the First Amendment to say everything they do is speech, and therefore everything they do is beyond regulation. And I mean, you could not ask for a more destructive kind of political economic formation than, you know, this sort of center of technological power coupled with a tool that lets them say you can't, laws don't apply to us. That's a good way of saying it. Laws don't apply to us.
Well, why? What is the logic of the more digital technology develops, the freer things will be? Is it just simply that this is the cutting edge of society on some level, and therefore, as it spreads its wings, as its logic unfolds, it's all going to be to the good? I mean, what is at the crux of this argument about digital technology in particular as a realm of its own for the greater good?
So if you read some of the excellent scholarship on the early history of some of these digital politics by Fred Turner, especially, who's a media studies scholar at Stanford,
right,
or even if you see Adam Curtis's wonderful documentary series, All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace, what you see is that there is this equation of personal power, the kind of power that the user feels sitting at the computer, with a kind of freedom, right? And that experience of power that many people have sitting at the computer, but especially people who are very attracted to the technology, that personal power is freedom to them, right? They feel like they are getting more freedom. And there is an equation between that personal freedom that they feel they are experiencing and a kind of political freedom. But as Turner points out, you know, some of the people who were some of the earliest advocates of this position were sitting inside their air-conditioned computer offices at Stanford and Berkeley when outside their windows you had the civil rights movement happening, sometimes threatening to come in and burn down the computers. And so you had these people who were saying freedom proceeds from the computers, but it doesn't proceed from what is happening outside with people who are protesting for civil rights and against the war and economic equality and women's rights and so forth. And that explains part of this bifurcation, right? That it was people who really thought that, who really had a strong distaste for leftist politics, but instead a kind of personal politics. And that's why Curtis also talks about it in terms of Ayn Rand, who happens to be a huge hero of many of these people, right? Rand portrays this kind of heroic individual who is often economically very powerful, pursuing their own economic interests. And this romantic, weird idea of the more power I can get somehow equates to more social freedom is deeply baked into the Silicon Valley understanding of the world. And it is, you know, it is, properly speaking, antisocial. It does not think about what is good for everyone. It thinks about what is good for me. And if it's good for me, it must be good for everyone, and even if I actually can't articulate that connection at all.
And ironically, for a lot of people, that sense, to the degree to which people share or feel that sense of freedom in the digital realm, of course, the reality has been that what seems like freedom in many ways is actually the opposite, because of the degree to which commercial entities in fact really rule the rules of the cyber universe.
Absolutely. And they use that, the commercial entities use that freedom to manipulate people at an unprecedented level. And they do use freedom. I mean, to just give a brief example, you know, there was some proposed legislation recently, the Stop Electronic Sex Trafficking Act, that would have chipped away, and maybe will chip away just a little bit at that Section 230 freedom, in the name of people, children especially, who are being sex trafficked online. And you can watch or listen to the hearing, congressional hearings about this. And you do have tech industry representatives come in there and use words like freedom to describe what they want, which is to block this legislation from passing. And it is the cognitive dissonance necessary to even process this is kind of startling, that you have these activists in there talking about how much damage is done to people's lives when they are sex trafficked. And then you have people coming in and saying, well, Google is really the locus of freedom. And if you do anything to impede it, you're damaging society. And it's a remarkable indication of how far we have come, that we can even have that kind of position be articulated in front of Congress.
Let me end by asking you, where do you see this all headed? Now, we've been talking in this hour about Bitcoin and a larger right-wing cyber-libertarian ideology that undergirds Bitcoin. What do you think about the future of Bitcoin itself, and if that future is not positive, how it might end up influencing the appeal of that larger ideology?
Well, I do think that ideology is coming under some criticism, as I mentioned before, for a lot of reasons. And I'm hopeful that in fact, there will be some moves toward regulation, and that the GDPR thing in the EU will be taken seriously and maybe effective in part, and that some of the various ways, you know, which are usually clumped under fake news, but some of the ways that that media manipulation was used to fuel the recent politics in the US and the UK and elsewhere may come under examination and may result in some regulation. I think that because Bitcoin is this giant unregulated trading market, that it is likely to crash at any given moment. And we've seen it crash recently, right, from a high of $20,000 to something like $7,000 today, which is an enormous collapse. And I do think that will help scare people away scare not the technology people, but, you know, the people you see stories about selling their homes and stuff to invest in Bitcoin. I hope that keeps them away. There was a lot of part of what is also interesting about this is that there's a huge amount of business interest in Bitcoin and the software that run it. And despite the rhetoric of the Bitcoin promoters that this is going to produce individual freedom, of course, without regulation or any other kind of law, you get concentrated capital investing in it. And one of the interesting things about that is I think that the Bitcoin software model, although it is innovative, I think it is much less distinctive than people want to say it is, right? There's a lot of other software out there that does a lot of the functions that Bitcoin does, while not exactly replicating it, but, 90% in various ways. And I think that those uses are really non-revolutionary in many ways, so that you're likely to see companies adopting this model and it having very little impact on what anybody actually does. And that and we have seen some of this so far, that some of the more florid use cases that have been come up, that the promoters have come up with, are going to be blocked by laws and regulation. The Bitcoin people will scream about that, but I think that they are, at least so far, I believe that, these ideologies are not well thought through, even by the crypto anarchist people, and their kind of faith that the government simply could not regulate this thing because it existed outside of it and because it's run on all these computers, I think is just wrong. And hopefully we'll see that it's wrong.
I've been speaking with David Golumbia. He is the author of The Politics of Bitcoin, Software as Right-Wing Extremism. His other books include The Cultural Logic of Computation, and he teaches in the English Department and the Media Art and Text PhD program at Virginia Commonwealth University. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.